34. For 3 days, or perhaps it was four, the time went by like a blur, Severa moved southward through the forest. She had no plan except to stay alive. There was no point in even trying to get back to her apartment. The city still seemed to be burning. A low curtain of smoke hung in the air wherever she looked, and occasionally she saw a sinuous tongue of red flame licking into the sky on the horizon. It appeared to her as if new fires were being started every day, which meant that the craziness had not yet begun to abate. She could feel her own mind returning gradually to normal, clearing day by day, blessedly emerging into clarity as though she were awakening from some terrible fever. She was uncomfortably aware that she wasn't fully herself yet. Managing any sequence of thoughts was a laborious thing for her, and she lost herself quickly in a muddle. But she was on her way back, of that she was sure. Apparently, many of the others around her in the forest weren't recovering at all. Though Safira was trying to keep to herself as much as she could, she encountered people from time to time, and most of them looked pretty badly deranged, sobbing, moaning, laughing wildly, glaring weirdly, rolling over and over on the ground. Just as Sheeran had suggested, some had suffered such mental trauma during the time of the crisis that they might never be sane again. Huge segments of the population must have lapsed into barbarism or worse, Safira realized. They must be setting fires for the sheer fun of it now, or killing for the same reason. So she moved carefully. With no particular destination in mind, she drifted more or less southward across the forest, camping wherever she found fresh water. The club that she had picked up on the evening of the eclipse was never very far from her hand. She ate whatever she could find that looked edible. Seeds, nuts, fruits, even leaves and bark. It wasn't much of a diet. She knew that she was strong enough physically to endure a week or so on such improvised rations, but after that, she'd begin to suffer. Already she could feel what little extra weight she had been carrying dropping away, and her physical resilience beginning little by little to diminish. And the supply of berries and fruits was diminishing too, very rapidly as the forest's thousands of hungry new inhabitants picked it over. Then, on what she believed was the fourth day, Safira remembered about the sanctuary. Her cheeks flamed as she realized that there had been no need for her to have been living this cave woman life all week. Of course, how could she have been so stupid? Just a few miles from here at this very moment, hundreds of university people were tucked away safe and sound in the old particle accelerator lab, drinking bottled water and dining pleasantly on the canned foods that they had spent the last few months stashing away. How ridiculous to be skulking around in this forest full of madmen, scratching in the dirt for her meager meals, and looking hungrily at the little forest creatures that cavorted beyond her reach on the branches of trees. She would go to the sanctuary. Somehow there would be a way to get them to take her in. It was a measure of the extent to which the stars had disrupted her mind, she told herself, that it had taken her as long as this to remember that the sanctuary was there. Too bad, she thought, that the idea hadn't occurred to her earlier. She realized now that she had spent the last few days traveling in precisely the wrong direction. Directly ahead of her now lay the steep chain of hills that marked the southern boundary of the forest. Looking up, she could see the blackened remains of the posh Onos Heights real estate development along the summit of the hill that rose like a dark wall before her. The sanctuary, if she remembered correctly, was the opposite way entirely, midway between the campus and Sorrow City on the highway running along the north side of the forest. It took her another day and a half to make her way back through the forest to the north side. In the course of the journey, she had to use her club twice to fight off attackers. She had three non-violent but edgy staring matches with young men sizing her up to decide whether she could be jumped. And once she blundered into a sheltered copse where five gaunt, wild-eyed men with knives were stalking one another in a circle, like dancers moving in some strange archaic ritual. She got away from there as fast as she could. Finally, she saw the wide highway that was University Road ahead of her, just beyond the forest boundary. Somewhere along the north side of that road was the unobtrusive little country lane that led to the sanctuary. Yes, there it was, hidden, insignificant, bordered on both sides by untidy clumps of weeds and thick grass that had gone to seed. It was late afternoon. Onos was almost gone from the sky, and the hard, baleful light of Tano and Sitha cast sharp shadows across the land that gave the day a wintry look, though the air was mild. The little red eye that was Dovim moved through the northern heavens, still very distant, still very high. Safira wondered what had become of the unseeable Kalgash II. Evidently, it had done its terrible work and moved on. By this time, it might be a million miles out in space, curving away from the world on its long orbit, riding on and on through the airless dark, not to return for another 2,049 years. Which would be at least 2 million years too soon, thought Sephira bitterly. A sign appeared before her. Private property. No trespassing. By order of Board of Proctors, Saro University. And then a second sign in vivid scarlet. Danger. High energy research facility. No entry. Good. She must be going the right way then. Sephira had never been to the sanctuary, even in the days when it had still been a physics laboratory. But she knew what to expect. A series of gates, and then some sort of scanner post that would monitor anyone who had managed to get this far. Within minutes, she had come to the first gate. It was a double-hinged screen of tightly woven metal mesh, rising to perhaps twice her height, with a formidable-looking barbed wire fence stretching off at either end and disappearing into the brambled underbrush that grew uncontrollably here. The gate was ajar. She studied it, puzzled. Some illusion? Some trick of her muddled mind? No, the gate was open, all right, and it was the correct gate. She saw the university security symbol on it, but why was it open? There was no indication that it had been forced. Troubled now, she went through. The road inward was nothing more than a dirt track, deeply rutted and cratered. She followed along its edge, and in a little while she saw an inner barrier. No mere barbed wire fence here, but a solid concrete wall, blank, impregnable looking. It was broken only by a gateway of dark metal with a scanner mounted above it. And this gate was open, too. Stranger and stranger. What about all the vaunted protection that was supposed to have sealed the sanctuary away from the general madness that had overtaken the world? She stepped inside. Everything was very quiet here. Ahead of her lay some scruffy-looking wooden sheds and barns. Perhaps the sanctuary entrance itself, the mouth of an underground tunnel, Sephira knew, lay behind them. She walked around the outbuildings. Yes, there was the sanctuary entrance, an oval door in the ground with a dark passageway behind it. And there were people, too, a dozen or so of them, standing in front of it, watching her with chilly, unpleasant curiosity. They all had strips of bright green cloth tied about their throats, as a kind of neckerchief. She didn't recognize any of them. So far as she could tell, they weren't university people. A small bonfire was burning just to the left of the door. Beside it was a pile of chopped logs, elaborately stacked, every piece of wood very neatly arranged according to size, with astonishing precision and care. It looked more like some sort of meticulous architect's model than a woodpile. A sickening sense of fear and disorientation swept over her. What was this place? Was it really the sanctuary? Who were these people? "Stay right where you are," said the man at the front of the group. He spoke quietly, but there was a whip-snapping authority in his tone. "Put your hands in the air." He held a small, sleek needle gun in his hand. It was pointing straight at her midsection. Sephira obeyed without a word. He appeared to be about 50 years old, a strong, commanding figure, almost certainly the leader here. His clothing looked costly, and his manner was poised and confident. The green neckerchief he wore had the sheen of fine silk. "Who are you?" he asked calmly, keeping the weapon trained on her. "Sephira 89, Professor of Archaeology, Saro University." "That's nice. Are you planning to do any archaeology around here, Professor?" The others laughed as though he had said something very, very funny. Sephira said, "I'm trying to find the university sanctuary. Can you tell me where it is?" "I think this might have been it," the man replied. "The university people all cleared out of here a few days back. This is Fire Patrol headquarters now. Tell me, are you carrying any combustibles, Professor?" "Combustibles? Matches, lighter, a pocket generator, anything that could be used to start a fire." She shook her head. "Not any of those things. Fire starting's prohibited under Article 1 of the Emergency Code. If you're in violation of Article 1, the punishment is severe." Sephira stared at him blankly. What was he talking about? A thin, sallow-faced man standing beside the leader said, "I don't trust her, Altenal. It was those professors that started all this. 2-1, she's got something hidden away in her clothes, out of sight somewhere." "I have no fire-making equipment anywhere on me," Sephira said, irritated. Altenal nodded. "Perhaps, perhaps not. We won't take the chance, Professor. Strip." She stared at him, startled. "What did you say?" "Strip. Remove your clothes. Demonstrate that you have no concealed illegal devices anywhere on your person." Sephira hefted her club, rubbing her hand uneasily along its shaft. Blinking in astonishment, she said, "Hold on here. You can't be serious. Article 2 of the Emergency Code, Fire Patrol, may take any precaution deemed necessary to prevent unauthorized fire starting. Article 3, this may include immediate and summary execution of those who resist fire patrol authority. Strip, Professor, and do it quickly." He gestured with the needle gun. It was a very serious-looking gesture. But still she stared at him. Still she made no move to remove her garments. "Who are you? What's this fire patrol stuff all about?"
"Citizen vigilantes, Professor. We're attempting to restore law and order in Sorrow after the breakdown. The city's been pretty much destroyed, you know. Or maybe you don't. The fires are continuing to spread, and there's no functioning fire department to do anything about it anymore. And maybe you people haven't noticed, but the whole province is full of crazy people who think we haven't quite had enough fires yet as it is. So they're starting even more. That can't go on. We intend to stop the starters by any means available. You are under suspicion of possessing combustibles. The accusation has been placed, and you have 60 seconds to clear yourself of the charge. If I were you, I'd start getting my clothes off, Professor."
Sephira could see him silently counting off the seconds. Strip? In front of a dozen strangers? A red haze of fury surged through her at the thought of the indignity. Most of these people were men. They weren't even bothering to hide their impatience. This wasn't any sort of security precaution, despite Altenall's solemn citing of an emergency code. They just wanted to see what her body looked like, and they had the power to make her submit. It was intolerable. But then, after a moment, she found her indignation beginning to slip away. What did it matter? Sephira asked herself wearily. The world had ended. Modesty was a luxury that only civilized people indulged in, and civilization was an obsolete concept. In any case, this was a blunt order at gunpoint. She had wandered into a remote, isolated place far down a country road. No one was going to come and rescue her here. The clock was ticking. And Altenall didn't seem to be bluffing. It wasn't worth dying just for the sake of concealing her body from them. She tossed her club to the ground. Then, in cold anger, but without permitting herself to make any outward show of rage, she began methodically to peel away her garments and drop them down beside it. "My underwear, too?" she asked sardonically.
"Everything."
"Does it look as if I've got a lighter hidden in here?"
"You've got 20 seconds left, Professor."
Sephira glowered at him and finished undressing without another word. It was surprisingly easy, now that she had done it, to stand naked in front of these strangers. She didn't care. That was the essential thing that came with the end of the world, she realized. She didn't care. She pulled herself up to her full imposing height and stood there, almost defiantly revealed, waiting to see what they'd do next. Altenall's eyes traveled over her body in an easy, self-assured way. Somehow she found herself not even caring about that. A kind of burned-out indifference had come over her.
"Very nice, Professor," he said finally.
"Thank you." Her tone was icy. "May I cover myself now?" He waved grandly.
"Of course. Sorry for the inconvenience, but we had to be absolutely sure."
He slipped the needle gun into a band at his waist and stood with his arms folded, casually watching her as she dressed. Then he said,
"You must think you've fallen in among savages, isn't that so, Professor?"
"Does what I think really interest you?"
"You'll notice that we didn't leer or drool or wet our clothes while you were demonstrating that you had no concealed fire-making apparatus, nor did anyone attempt to molest you in any way."
That was extremely kind. Altenall said,
"I point these things out even though I realize it's not likely to make much difference to you while you're still this angry at us, because I want you to know that what you've stumbled across here may in fact be the last remaining bastion of civilization in this godforsaken world. I don't know where our beloved governmental leaders have disappeared to, and I certainly don't consider our cherished brethren of the Apostles of Flame to be in any way civilized. And your university friends, who used to be hidden out here, have picked up and gone away. Just about everybody else seems to be clear out of his mind. Except, that is, for you and us, Professor."
"How flattering of you to include me."
"I never flatter anybody. You give an appearance of having withstood the darkness and the stars and the breakdown better than most. What I want to know is whether you're interested in staying here and becoming part of our group. We need people like you, Professor. What does that mean? Scrub floors for you? Cook soup? Altenol seemed impervious to her sarcasms. I mean, helping in the struggle to keep civilization alive, Professor. Not to sound too high-pitched about it, but we see ourselves as having a holy mission. Day after day, we're making our way through that madhouse out there, disarming the crazies, taking the fire-making apparatus away from them, reserving to ourselves exclusively the right to light fires. We can't put the fires out that are already burning, at least not yet, but we can do our best to keep new ones from being lit. That's our mission, Professor. We are taking control of the concept of fire. It's the first step toward making the world fit to live in again. You seem sane enough to join us, and therefore I invite you in. What do you say, Professor? Do you want to be part of the fire patrol? Or would you rather try your luck back there in the forest?